I'd like to call this recessed meeting back to order. Today is the, I think the 14th now? Yes. 13th of April at 5 p.m. This is a meeting of the House Resources Committee in room 124. We have a quorum to meet because present are Representative Birch, Representative Parrish, Vice Chair Westlake, and the co-chairs Josephson and Tarr. The record, as I said, can reflect that we have a quorum. Today, our recording secretary, per usual, is Deborah Tillinghast. She's with us. And our LIO moderator is Matt Kern. I believe I've said that right. And today, we are going to continue. I think we actually had just invited testimony on HJR 9. So we are going to open up public testimony on HJR 9, and I'll do that now. So public testimony is open on House Joint Resolution 9 on the transboundary mining issue. And I will start with the callers. And I'll start with Jode Sparks in Soldotna.
Hi, my name is Jody Sparks, and I'm representing Alaska Youth for Environmental Action. And my group, which we call AHA, is a group of diverse politically minded teens from across the state. And at our last conference, at what we call the Civic Summit, I learned about HJR 9. And I support HJR 9 because I support sustainable salmon. When I got back to my hometown of Soldotna, on the Kenai Peninsula, I talked to my AP bio class about HJR 9, and they overwhelmingly supported it. And my biology teacher totally supported it because the bill would have minimal impacts on Alaskan industry, but would help save Alaska salmon. The Southeast is pretty far from Kenai, but we share a cultural and economic dependence on salmon. All of us fish for fun in the summer here, and some of us even work at commercial fish sites. The fishing provides employment for over 10,000 people in South Central Alaska. And that doesn't even include the vital role that salmon play here in attracting tourism. And I mention that because I know that HJR 9 would mainly help salmon in Southeast, but people from all over Alaska support salmon, and we all want healthy salmon in the future. Alaskans also want our state to have a say in our own industries, and this resolution would help with the process so that we could have a say in mines that affect our waters. As political advocates and biology students, as salmon lovers and as young Alaskans, we urge the legislature to pass HJR 9. Thank you for considering my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Any questions for Mr. Sparks? I don't see any. We're going to move on to Ketchikan with Tony Galagoff. Mr. Galagoff, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Mr. Galagoff, please give us your name and affiliation first.
Okay, I'm sorry. My name is Tony Gallegos. I'm the Cultural and Natural Resource Director for the Ketchikan Indian Community.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I am going to read to you a resolution from the tribe, KIC 17-14, a resolution in support of Alaska House Joint Resolution 9. And I'll skip the boilerplate and get to some of the key points. Whereas British Columbia says that their mines can be developed responsibly, but reports by the Office of the Auditor General in British Columbia in 2011 and 2016 have found that this is not the case. And whereas our concerns are about the long-term health of our fishes and rivers, we want enforceable measures to protect these resources long into the future, not just with current development. And whereas binding enforceable measures are needed to properly address Alaskan concerns for the transboundary mining activity, and whereas the statement of cooperation between the state of Alaska and British Columbia does not guarantee or ensure monitoring will occur at all, much less over the very long term, and provides no funding for such monitoring. Also, monitoring on its own without any long-term funding funding system for responding to and paying for pollution events is not enough. And whereas the long-term cumulative impacts from existing and future British Columbia mining projects need to actively take into account Alaska's natural resources. And whereas House Joint Resolution 9 is a proactive attempt to deal with potential impacts before they become actual impacts. Whereas British Columbia's current processes inherently cannot provide a mechanism or funds to ensure proper cleanup events like the catastrophic 2014 Mount Polly mine tailings dam failure and compensation to people affected by such events. And whereas concerns are being dismissed as inflated and based on ignorance, yet there are real concerns for worry, reasons for worry. Decisions need to be based on sound science, tribal environmental knowledge, the law, treaties, and agreements with tribes and First Nations. And whereas the Federal Boundary Waters Treaty should be honored, specifically Articles 4 and 9, and whereas British Columbia needs to, in good faith, fund and implement a robust monitoring and maintenance network to ensure protection of transboundary waters in perpetuity. It is therefore resolved that the Ketchikan Indian Communities Tribal Council basically urges the government, U.S. government, to work with Canada to investigate long-term downstream effects of proposed and existing industrial development in B.C. and develop measures working with the state to protect the state's resources.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gayagoff. That's all the time we have, although we'll always welcome questions for you, and there's one from Representative Parrish for you, Mr. Gayagoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I'd just like to ask real quickly, how many people does your tribal council represent?
6,000, or a little over 6,000 total. We're like the second largest tribe in the state, the largest tribe in Southeast Alaska. There are more than 3,000 members residing in the area.
Wow. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. We're going to move on to Frederick Olson, Jr. On POW, Prince of Wales Island.
Hello.
Yes, Mr. Olson, give us your name and affiliation, and we invite your testimony.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I'm Frederick Olson, Jr., and I am the chairman of the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group, and I'm also the tribal vice president of the Organized Village of Kassam. And thank you to the chair and to the rest of the committee, to the people in the audience there. Please, I apologize in advance if I offend anyone. It is definitely not my intention. But sometimes an example I give may not be to your liking, but please don't be offended. You cannot like it, but it's not meant to offend. And just to note, you know, the Organized Village of Kassam did pass a resolution in support of HJR9. And my words contradict others, but they're not meant to be personal. What's personal is our close relationship to our region and the land. However, listening at previous hearings, it's clear, you know, the House Fisheries Committee, the Representative Ortiz, Bryce Tompkins, et cetera, clearly listened to testimony last year and to create HDR9 in the first place, and I speak today in support. The resolution could maybe be slightly stronger, mentioning the United States of America's fiduciary trust responsibility and government-to-government relationship with federally recognized tribes. And on behalf of Alaska Native tribal citizens, we call on the United States to pursue a referral to the International Joint Commission under the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909. The Boundary Waters Treaty, in Article 4, it mentions harm and potential harm caused by one side or the other. As we speak, the Tulsiqua Chief Mine is polluting the Taku River watershed. We have the Bruce Jack Mine that possibly could have already been affecting the Unic River, and the Red Chris Mine is now threatening the Stikine River. If you needed a harm or potential harm, Article 4 would trigger that. But also, Boundary Waters Treaty Article 9 mentions from time to time these kinds of issues could be looked at. And remember, it's the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909, and this is 2017. It's never been implemented on the Alaska-Canada border, so perhaps it's time. And, you know, it is very hard to listen to sometimes. People give misstatements and half-truths or made-up things that then stand for facts by in the minds of good-meaning folks that don't know better. And I heard some of that yesterday. You know, a treaty between two countries with federal systems would obviously require federal involvement for the enforcement of such a document. But the people motivated by money will say anything. You know, to call that federal overreach, please, calling federal overreach to a enforcement of a treaty is quite a reach itself. You know, that's what treaties are. And, you know, using that tired old saw is bad enough.
Okay.
But in this context, it's either ignorance on display or maybe something sinister, you know, an agenda being displayed. You know, selling out the health of tens of thousands of Alaskans for a few dollars more for themselves is not what we should be going for. And
right.
Please don't listen to that. That kind of willfully ignorant stuff disguised as experts wanting this.
Mr. Olson?
This is why, you know, pardon the expression, but regular people distrust politics and politicians because of this kind of misuse. You know, we like
Mr. Olson?
Memorandum of understanding.
Why can't they hear when I do that? Mr. Olson? You expressed some concern with offending us, and I'm not offended yet, but I am time limited. Can you wrap up
okay.
in just a sentence or two?
Economic impact of a disaster on the other side of the border. We're talking about major. Everyone's heard of Mount Polly and that disaster. Projects like KSM dwarf Mount Polly. And when one of those come down our rivers, you know, no amount of money will bring back the dead. And, you know, our way of life on this side of the border cannot be merely a cost of doing business. International solutions require international, you know, and so anyway, it's clear that it needs international solution.
Okay.
And, you know, we can figure this out, but we need to talk about the real issue and not make stuff up, you know.
All right.
The MOU and SOC is not legally binding.
I understand.
It's analogous to, like, your neighborhood watch. But the neighborhood watch still requires the police. You know,
okay. Mr. Olson, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. If there is a written resolution from your working group, we would invite that. You can email that to me or to the members. And that also goes for Mr. Gayagoff. I neglected to mention that to him. We're going to move on to Brian Lynch in Petersburg. And we're going to have to restrict this to 2 minutes. I will try to make it a sort of liberal 2 minutes, but 2 minutes. And I only say that because we've got...
Hey, thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HGR 9. I am Brian Lynch. I am a retired ADFMG commercial fisheries management biologist with over 30 years' experience in Southeast Alaska. I now work part-time for Rivers Without Borders. This issue isn't about the management of Alaska's resources. It is one of ensuring that activities on the other side of the international border do not harm those very resources and the industries that depend on them on our side of the border. HGR 9 has nothing to do with the Alaska's mining industry or how we manage our resources. Federal involvement would complement, not compromise, the SOC and the position. All of the members of our congressional delegation have spoken out against federal overreach on other issues, but all strongly support federal intervention in this issue. In fact, if there was a real concern about federal overreach, I doubt we would have this level of support from our delegation. During last week's fisheries hearing and yesterday's resources hearing, some comments were made that I found to be quite troubling. They had to do with what I'd characterize as a greater concern for the BC and Canadian mining industry than for existing and sustainable Alaskan seafood industry and thousands of existing jobs. I have lived in Petersburg for 36 years, a community whose economic lifeblood is the seafood industry. A mining disaster or related contamination in any of the transboundary watersheds would have significant, if not devastating, impact on not only Petersburg's economy, but all of Southeast Alaska, and could even have negative impacts across the Gulf and into the Bering Sea. River estuaries support crab and halibut fisheries. Any disaster that would contaminate these systems could impact marine species even longer than salmon, since the toxic material emanating from a mine disaster would settle in these species' habitats and would be difficult or impossible to clean up. These sorts of effects are now being seen following the 2015 Samarco mining disaster in Brazil. Fisheries across the Gulf and into the Bering Sea could also be impacted if any transboundary king salmon stocks were listed under the ESA as a result of a mining disaster. There are biological opinions of no jeopardy for the Gulf and Bering Sea trawl fisheries that limit the bycatch of listed king salmon. Any additional listings could impact those biops and reduce the allowable bycatch in those fisheries, which in turn would reduce the target species catch. Those fisheries are multi-billion dollar fisheries. So please keep in mind that the financial impacts of a mine disaster could be very extensive, and this is why enforceable financial assurances that could only be implemented with federal involvement are so absolutely necessary. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to field any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. I don't see any questions, so we're going to move on to Karen Mathias in Anchorage.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Josephson, Co-Chair Tarr, and members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Karen Mathias, and I'm the Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers, a statewide business association that represents the large metal mines and some advanced projects in Alaska. Among other things, the Council promotes economic opportunity and environmentally sound mining practices. I also represent the Council on the Lieutenant Governor's Citizens Working Group on Transboundary Issues. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on HJR 9. Recognizing the need to protect and enhance the shared environment, CAP fully supports collaboration and dialogue between the state of Alaska and the province of BC on development in BC along these rivers that flow from Canada into Alaska. For more than 2 years, Lieutenant Governor Malotte has shown great leadership in deepening the existing levels of communication and cooperation between the state and the province on this issue. This work has included an unprecedented level of outreach to stakeholder groups. The MOU and SOC are both the results of this effort and the starting point for greater collaboration between the province and the state. In fact, the technical working work has already begun, and I encourage you to ask for an update from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Natural Resources, and Fish and Game. They could also provide you with comparisons of BC and Alaska permitting, which some members have asked for. We're not opposed to federal involvement, although we don't believe it would provide timely or meaningful results. But I urge you to consider amendments to this resolution that would recognize the value of the statement of cooperation, the work of the technical groups, and the efforts of the Lieutenant Governor and the State of Alaska to ensure that our state regulators can have meaningful access and input into the regulatory process in British Columbia. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Mathias. Any questions for her? I don't see any. So now we are in the room only. And so I see some folks have signed up, and they include Graham Neal.
I was highlighting the good parts in the interest of time. Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Graham Neal, and I am a miner, an educator, and a volunteer, and have been involved with resources in Alaska and British Columbia for 20 years. I've also been a Canadian my entire life, and I'm currently working, living, and playing in Southeast Alaska. I work in what I think is a very dynamic industry. I like my cell phone. I like my truck. I like going to movies. And like most miners I know, I really, really, really like to fish. In the most Canadian of sincerities, I'd like to politely ask everybody to please keep some perspective. We're talking about Canada. which is a punchline to some, and I've heard all the jokes, but it's envied by others for its good looks and impeccable manners, and generally respected around the world as a responsible nation. To the issue at hand, British Columbia's motto is Beautiful British Columbia. It says so right on our license plates. I had a story here about fishing, but in the interest of time, I think you get the point. Growing up with my dad and my uncle, we fished a lot. But there currently exists a working relationship and an open dialogue, an MOU and an SOC between the province of British Columbia and the state of Alaska. And this all came together in 2 years, which personally I think is a monument in itself. BC Minister Mines and Energy Bill Bennett and some of the proponents of the projects in BC have invested their own time and money in studies into modifications and outreach and publicly stated they care what Alaskans think, even though they currently don't have to. I can also assure you that BC has a history and a sentiment with Ottawa pretty much the same as Alaska does with TC, which is basically let us manage our own business. Mount Polly happened. You can't take that back, and all of us wish I could. And myself, as a minor Canadian, I was as concerned and as disgusted as anybody. I have family who lives in likely British Columbia, one of the communities that was affected. But what gets talked about very little was how the reaction was not a shrug of the shoulders, and, oh, well, let's put some dirt on it and get back to work. There was a full stop, an investigation, repercussions, and a commitment to be better, which you can't ask much more from your neighboring country. And that's also a modern invention. 100 years ago, on both sides of the border and all up and down the coast, you found an outcrop, staked a claim, dug a hole, broke some rock, and took what metal you could and left, often leaving a hole in the ground, a pile of rusty waste rock, the steel you no longer needed. And we don't do that anymore because there's too many other things that we care about. Also, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip that. But more important than anything I've said today about what I am, where I'm from, or what I do, I'm a father to a 5-year-old boy. I would very much like to fish with him as well. So personally, I would never keep myself in a position in an industry or a jurisdiction where I thought those values were at risk. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Any questions for Mr. Neal? Yes, Representative Birch.
I was going to say, excellent testimony, very abbreviated. Would you like to leave written remarks? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I can email to the chairs or to the committee.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you. Well said.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Mr. Chair, and through the chair, thank you, Mr. Neal, for your testimony. You're probably aware that I've got most of the miners from two of the five biggest mines in the state living in my district. And I really do appreciate a great deal the excellent work that they've done at environmental protection. Oh, and then I hear I hear a little bit about some of the more egregious errors, mistakes made in Canada, and I can't help but to be troubled by the contrast between Tulsa Kwachief and Mount Polly and my Kensington and Greens Creek, which are, you know, just top of the class. And I'm looking at the comments of the Auditor General on the Ministry of Energy and Mines, and it's not great. So what's being done to bring us to a greater level of confidence, and why? Yeah, what's happening? What's being done?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, thank you. I don't work for the BC government. I can't claim to testify on behalf of a nation or a province, but as I said in my testimony, there are legacy concerns all up and down the coast on both sides of the border from activities that occurred before there were regulations or pre-permitting or environmental assessments or whatever the case may be. That's just the nature of the business that we're in, and the modern conveniences that we've created for ourselves. They come from that. I think what we learned in the Polly situation is there are repercussions, and there is a commitment to do better, as I said. I don't really want to single out any specific legacy projects or mines, but they're not isolated, I would say.
Thank you, Mr. Neal.
Okay. Yes, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So were you speaking in favor or opposition to the resolution?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. I joked with Representative Ortiz that I hope we could still be friends at the end of this. I'm in favor of the diplomatic situation that currently exists between the state and the province of British Columbia. I am in favor of involving federal involvement when it is called for. I do find it interesting that in an era, Alaska and British Columbia are much the same, in an era where we are demanding less federal overreach on this specific issue, we're actually requesting federal overreach. So I remain neutral on the actual resolution because I do support just diplomatic and common sense relations.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Neal. We're going to go now to Laura Statz in the room.
Good afternoon. Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Laura Statz. I live at 418 7th Street here in Juneau, Alaska. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here representing myself, my children, my grandchild, and my extended family. We come from a commercial fishing family. Although my husband and I are not in the industry, my husband's siblings, our son and nephew, gillnet or troll in southeast Alaskan waters. On the boats, the Mara, the Cindy K, the Phoenix, the Martina, and the Olori. But an Alaskan need not be a fisherman to understand the bounty of salmon and the vast marine ecosystem to which we are connected. We are witnesses to streams that fill with our salmon, returning in the fall, seals, sea lions, whales, and etc. In Southeast, we are witness to a rare occurrence on the planet, and it is up to us to take care of our great resource. It is a generation ago that in Lynn Canal and Chatham Strait were filled with herring. My husband talks about the Tlingit setting out spruce branches in Auk Bay that would become thick with herring roe. That is no more. The environment which has been entrusted to us is rare and abundant. Our stewardship is of the utmost importance. And that is why I ask you to vote in favor of HJR 9. Our perplexing budget deficit makes it poignantly evident that Alaska is at an important crossroads. It is in the best interest that we protect our environment to encourage the robust continuation of our salmon stocks and our economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Statz. Any questions for her? I don't see any. All right, so we've just had a new person call in, but first I'm going to go to Mr. Archibald. And we do have Ms. Hale, Michelle Hale, who runs the water division for DEC, if there are questions of those sorts. Yes. Mr. Archibald, give us your name, and we welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Guy Archibald. I reside here in Juneau. I am the Mining and Clean Water Coordinator for Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, and I'm an environmental chemist and microbiologist with 20 years' experience. I think, first of all, we have to look, is there a threat here? And yes, indeed, there's a threat. The Bowers Chambers report that was done last year, Dr. Dave Chambers was one of the authors, shows that these very types of modern mines, due to exploiting very low-grade ores and having to go at an economy of scale, actually fail at a higher rate and more catastrophically than smaller, older legacy mines. So this very type of mining, modern mining practices, has a higher rate of failure. Will these mines be built? Right now, BC Hydro, that was built to power these mines, is $18 billion in debt. And they have $22 billion on the books of future projects between now and 2025. The province of British Columbia is betting the bank on these mines being developed and going into production. The system in British Columbia is broken. It's clear from the expert panel report and the scathing Auditor General's report that business as usual should not continue. Part of that business as usual was to move away from watered tailings facility. 6 months after the Mount Polly disaster, British Columbia gave the permit for the Red Chris tailings facility, which is a watered tailings facility. The Brucejack mine, which is going to go online later this year, is also putting its tailings underwater. The KSM, Shaft Creek, Galore Creek, none of these have changed their plan of operations to move away from watered tailings facilities. It is true that British Columbia did modify some of their practices, but their modifications are all on paper. They formed a review board, a non-binding review board, to review tailings designs. They now require mines submit a management plan. They now require that mines give an annual report. And they created a new website. I'm not sure how that paper dam is going to hold up. I'm a little concerned, too, about the idea that maybe federal government involvement might be too little too late. The post-closure operating plan for the KSM mine, a huge mine, one of the, would be one of the it's considered the largest ore body in the world. It runs for 200 years. I think the federal government can have an impact sometime between now and 200 years from now. And I heard that bell go off, so I will respect the time limit.
Well, your testimony is among some of the most interesting for me. It's all been interesting, but the KSM mine itself has a 200-year lifespan?
That's what it calls for. They talk for mining for 52 years, but then having to have active water treatment and post-closure activities for 200 years. And I asked them directly, well, what magical thing happens on December 31st, year 199, and January 1st, year 200? Their answer was, well, that's when their predictive model breaks down. They just can't predict whether or not they will need active water treatment. We're talking water treatment at a rate of 119,000 gallons a minute discharged into the Unic River for 200 years. Nothing can go wrong. That just doesn't seem reasonable. And I also have to wonder about why the industry associations are so against this. Why are they against the federal government and the tools and expertise they can bring into this region? If I was investing in a mining company, I would want some assurances that that mining company is not going to turn into a liability.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Archibald? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Archibald. I believe you said that water storage of tailings is being discouraged. What is the alternative?
Representative Drummond, through the chair, one of the alternatives, and there's several of them, are a dry stack similar to what Greens Creek uses on Admiralty Island. Mm-hmm. It has been looked at in the case of the KSM. One of the recommendations from the panel, the technical panel, was that economic considerations not be the driver, that safety be the driver behind tailings dams mm-hmm. designs. But right now there are three considerations for design on tailings dams. Economics and financial feasibility is still one of them, along with environmental impacts and impacts to society. In Mount Polly, the water didn't cause the incident, but when the dam failed, because the tailings were in water, it mobilized them. So it created a lot more damage because of the water than would have been outside of the dry stack.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
All right, we have one more, and we're going back to the phone line for Deantha Crockett of the Alaska Miners Association. Are you there, Ms. Crockett?
I am. Thank you very much, Representative Josephson. Chair Josephson and Tara, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity today. My name is Deantha Crockett. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. AMA is the professional trade association for Alaska's mineral industry, mines large and small. We're represented in 8 statewide branches, including the southeast locations of Haines, Juneau, and our Ketchikan Prince of Wales branch. I'll note the AMA has a letter on the record in response to the first version of HGR 9 that points to the collaboration between the state of Alaska and the province of British Columbia led by Lieutenant Governor Malott. We point to the memorandum of understanding and the statement of cooperation agreed upon by both the state and the province and the technical work that's already begun to further the collaboration. At that time of submitting the letter, we suggested that the resolution reflect those important advancements in addressing any concerns regarding transboundary mining. However, when version B of this resolution was released, it included new language that insists on federal government intervention in the current collaboration being led by the Lieutenant Governor. It's surprising to us the legislature would be eager to request federal overreach into the proper management of Alaska's natural resources and regulatory management of those resources. The legislature should support the efforts on behalf of the Lieutenant Governor and support the regulatory mission of our agencies charged with oversight and development of the resources, rather than encouraging federal intervention and potentially compromising the cooperative relationship formalized in the Alaska-British Columbia Agreement. The Lieutenant Governor's efforts to establish the Transboundary Working Group has resulted in significant achievements, such as the state's participation on the Mine Review Committee for the Bruce Jack Gold Project and the KSM Project. These kind of results demonstrate that the state of Alaska and the province of British Columbia are working effectively to address their common interests in protecting the waters and fisheries that are vital to the citizens of both jurisdictions. We should ensure that we aren't doing anything to compromise the state of Alaska's ongoing collaborative efforts. Asking for federal involvement is not only unnecessary, but it cedes Alaska's authority to manage its resources to the federal government. AMA encourages you to instead focus energies on supporting Lieutenant Governor Malott and collaborating with our neighbors. Thanks again for the opportunity and getting me in at the last second here.
Sure. Any questions for Ms. Crockett? I don't see any. So I'm going to close public testimony at 5:37. And we have before us, does the House Resources Committee, version J of the bill or resolution, which is a committee substitute for House Joint Resolution Number 9, Fisheries. We did not receive, there was a request for any amendments. We did not receive any amendments. That is, the co-chairs didn't. So we have the resolution as it came to us. Is there any discussion about the resolution? Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I'm happy to support this resolution. I would like to say, however, that I do not consider it in any way a means of undercutting the excellent efforts of our Lieutenant Governor Malott, nor of the Transboundary Working Group. They are doing important work every time they meet. It's unfortunate that the regulatory authorities in British Columbia have fallen down on the job. But that is, quite frankly, the conclusion of their Auditor General, and it's manifestly apparent through their regulatory failures, such as the catastrophe at Mount Polly and the ongoing contamination of salmon waters by the Tulsa Chief Mine. I believe in level playing fields, and I believe that in Alaska we have very stringent expectations of our mines, and that they've risen to those expectations because we've had robust regulatory authority. And I think that if we see our Canadian neighbors with lower bonding expectations and with more lax enforcement, we are doing no favor to Alaskan miners, and we're putting Alaskan fisheries at risk. So I'm proud to support this.
Yes, Representative Birch.
Well, I share some of the concerns voiced during testimony regarding, I recognize this a resolution, not a force of law, but I think at the same time, I think we need to realize and recognize, be careful what you wish for. I think, as has been commented on earlier, the Lieutenant Governor and the government of British Columbia have been working closely together to try to work towards resolution of these issues. I think we need to recognize that there's a large economic component that we share. Obviously, a successful river system is right at the top. But I am concerned about bringing in or inviting the federal government in to start, kind of leading us down the road here. While I don't have anything specifically as an amendment or an offering, I do share those concerns with those that have testified earlier.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know exactly who to address this to, but I guess rivers go two directions. I mean, they go one direction, but they can go across the boundary from Canada to Alaska, as well as going from Alaska to Canada. Do we have anything? I mean, is there any rivers going their direction that this is going to be affecting as far as our our mines upstream to theirs. And I guess if we're going to get into transboundary issues, I guess I'm kind of curious if there's how it would work going the other direction, and if this has any impact in that way. And I don't know to speak.
I'm pretty confident the answer is no. And I'm also confident that we would hear maybe from the British Columbians in the event they had concerns. But I'm not a geologist and certainly not someone who knows. I just assume these things are flowing to the Pacific, but maybe I could be mistaken.
West of the Continental Divide, yes. We're going to the Pacific
Ocean. Mm-hmm. Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I am proud to support this as well and thank Representative Ortiz for bringing it forward. I think, you know, we have both the Mount Polley disaster to learn from and try to be preventative going forward. And frequently, you know, we have to do something in the wake of a disaster. This, I think, is a great opportunity for us to try and, you know, do something before the next bad thing happens and, you know, have the proper protections in place to ensure that our fisheries aren't damaged and for all of their importance. I think it'll benefit residents in both Canada and the United States and British Columbia and Alaska. And I don't think it'll take away from the work that's being done, you know, at the government-to-government level between the province and our state. And I commend the Lieutenant Governor for that initiative. However, we know that the only legally binding agreements between these two countries would have to come through the federal governments. And so I think in that sense we're a little bit limited in what our options are. And the fact that our congressional delegation has requested, you know, this very resolution so that they can show support for taking action, I think, you know, shows that we're all kind of on the same team and working together and going in the same direction. So I'll be supporting it today.
Okay. Yes. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm totally in support. This is a no-brainer to me. I do think we ought to quit talking about federal overreach, however, and see if we can get them to have just the right amount of reach in this case. Yes. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize I may have missed some of this, but if someone could enlighten me, it would be appreciative. So the person that brought this forward, I guess, do we have a sense of what the federal prevent? I'm looking at page 2, line 15. Whereas the federal provincial environmental assessment process does not address the long-term cumulative effects of industrial development in their transboundary region. I mean, is there a process? We have that process clearly. I mean, I guess I'm just wondering if we've seen that process.
I'll invite the sponsor
through the chair, Representative Johnson. I just need a little more clarification of your question. I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Well, I'm looking at page 2, line 15. It says, whereas the federal provincial environmental assessment process does not address, and then it goes on. I was just wondering if we've seen that process or if there's somewhere I can see that process. I mean, if there's a...
Through the chair. Go ahead.
Co-Chair Josephson, can we invite Jill up to answer this question because she'd be more equipped to answer it?
Yes, please.
I mean, I have a few questions, if I could, and just then someone can answer maybe more than one at a time.
Representative Johnson, we're going to take them one at a time.
Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Please put your name on the record.
Jill White's Salmon Beyond Borders, Juneau, Alaska. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Johnson. For an example to your question regarding the assessment process of both the Canadian federal and provincial government, one of the attempts for the new Trudeau administration to regain the public's trust in their environmental permitting process and assessment process was to conduct kind of a tour throughout Canada and taking public comment regarding their environmental assessment process. And in 2012, under the former Harper administration, they removed a stipulation within their environmental assessment process that suggested formally any project that had transboundary implications, so leaving jurisdictional boundaries would automatically trigger a federal environmental assessment, which receives the highest level of environmental review. That type of requirement has been removed from the environmental assessment process. Thank you.
Follow up?
I guess what I was trying to also just wondering where we would see. I mean, there's a statement that's very specific that says the federal provincial environmental assessment process, and I was just wondering what that refers to if you go to the source document. Is that?
If you can answer, please do so.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Johnson. So are you looking, can you clarify if you're looking for the fact that it does not address, you're looking for evidence that it does not address those impacts?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, okay. So I would, it's not in your briefing document, I don't believe, but the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act within there, I believe it's section, 36 maybe, but don't quote me on that, was removed from the former version of the Environmental Assessment Act.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Johnson?
I do. So you're saying the federal provincial environmental assessment refers, that's referring to the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act?
Through the chair, the Federal Environmental Assessment Act.
So I guess.
Follow up?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. I understood I was recognized, and I'll just continue. Is Mr. Chair, with a question? Or
you can. Please. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have some other bills as well that we'd like to get
into. Absolutely, okay. But I would imagine that we want to thoroughly.
We do.
If we're going to be looking at international relations here, yep. We might want to take a clear look at this.
We started the resolution yesterday, and we've been doing that. Yep. Please proceed.
So I was just wondering, I was looking at, page 2, and it says, it talks about it goes on and talks page 2, number 5, whereas proposed mines would generate billions of tons of acid generating tailings, which would be held behind huge dams and could pose the threat of acid rock drainage for century, if not in perpetuity. Whereas the tailings would need monitoring, maintenance, water treatment, possible remediation for centuries, if not in perpetuity. I mean, those are pretty strong statements. I guess I'm wondering if we've seen the mine plans. I mean, we've seen all the mine plans. Are those on file somewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, are you referring to, has the state of Alaska reviewed it, or is it made? Are those plans made publicly available?
Well, we're making a statement, so it's the state of Alaska making the statement.
Yes.
Saying that wood would generate billions of tons of acid-generating tailings. So I was just wondering there's facts listed in here, and I'm wondering where the facts come from. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, of course. Yes, these projects do have plans that have been reviewed. Primarily, the ones that we are focusing on have been reviewed by the state DNR, and as well as independent scientists that have submitted reports regarding these projects, those both within the permitting review process and those within operation.
May I try something, if it helps? If this were a court of law, which it is not, Ms. White's.
Yes.
Can you essentially attest, you're not under oath, but can you attest to having reviewed at some point in your career evidence that supports, for example, lines 5 through 7, that the many KSM, the Chris mine, et cetera, would generate indeed, under their own plans, billions of tons of acid-generating tailings? Have you personally read that sort of information?
Representative, Chair Josephson, yes, absolutely.
And if I could just follow up and ask, I mean, it's sort of common, it's my understanding, having, for example, toured the Fort Knox mine, that it's well known that an open pit mine in a large scale mine just by definition poses some threat, question is how much threat, of acid rock drainage. and the whole goal is to mitigate that or eliminate it. But even the mines themselves say, yes, it has to be monitored for over a century. Isn't that what they say? They themselves say, yep, we're going to have to monitor this for a century. Am I right about that?
Chair Josephson, every mining plan is different, so I wouldn't feel comfortable giving a general answer to that.
Okay.
But the treatment, the mine life is identified as well as the proposed water treatment. And as heard previously in other testimony, for example, the KSM project has projected 200 years of water treatment, but what happens after 200 years?
Okay.
Not perpetual, et cetera.
And we just heard testimony about that.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Any other questions?
I do, thank you. I guess, you know, I have concerns because I do know that water runs both ways. It's not just all going, I'm not just talking about southeast. I mean, we have the rest of our boundary. So I have to be aware that what we expect from upstream in Canada, we should be very much prepared to do upstream in Alaska as far as any drainage. And I guess I'm not saying that this holds us to it. I understand this is, you know, someone might say just a resolution, but I think it's important to remember it's a statement that is, well, it's not force of law. We shouldn't ever say it's just, it's still action of the legislature. And I'm just very aware that when we want to talk, it seems like a little bit like hyperbole when we start talking about what could happen. We know a lot of things could happen. So I'm wondering if we're looking at it in the sense that we want it applied to us as well. And that's from this is to the person that carries the resolution.
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, international water treaties and agreements are exactly that. They work both ways. And certainly what we would be, if in fact there are some added strength agreements as a result of potential international cooperation between the government of Canada and the United States, those agreements would be binding both ways. And I don't think that, you know, anybody would be opposed to that or not understand that. That would be something that would be commonly accepted, that yes, agreements go both ways, and we would expect ourselves to hold, you know, our standards to the same level that we would be asking the Canadian government to do.
May I just have one more follow-up?
Yes,
here?
Follow
Thank
up.
You. I'm trying to make sure we're working with the facts. We just didn't get excited when we writing up things, so pull it back a little bit. I mean, even looking on page 1, line 12, it says, whereas large-scale mining in British Columbia is experiencing unprecedented and rapid expansion in the Taku, Stikine, and Unik watersheds. Is that really unprecedented in Canada?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question.
Unprecedented?
Yes, because these mines haven't been developed before, and they are now being proposed in large numbers and big mines, and they weren't there before. And, you know, for the economic benefit of the people living in Canada, that's their right to do that. You know, we had heard previous testimony about the energy facility that's been put in specifically to provide energy to these potential mines. On the Canadian side, they're at this point now where they see it's to their benefit economically to develop these mines now. They could have done it previously in years past, but they didn't. But they're at the point now. And certainly in at a scale not seen before, unprecedented.
In the world?
Unprecedented in Canada, for sure. I mean, I think members from the mining group would attest to that.
And Representative Johnson, it doesn't say in the world.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. It says
It says British Columbia. It says
is British it just
Columbia
within those watersheds?
What's
or
that?
Isn't it just within those watersheds, or is it within? I guess I'm just trying to figure out what the verbiage, what it means exactly.
The through the chair, Representative Johnson, this resolution addresses several, if not more than several, I know more than several actually, mines, proposed mines, planned mines for the future that would affect, potentially affect, these three watersheds that we're talking about, the Taku, the Unic, and the Stikine.
Unprecedented. I mean, some big mines in the world.
But Representative Johnson, the sentence in question doesn't refer to the other mines in the world.
Okay, I'm just wanted to clarify that, because there's a lot in the resolution that's not entirely clear what's factual and what is hyperbole, and that's all I'm trying to say.
Well, and let me recommend that in the future, you could research the information and see whether it's challengeable. I mean, your comment that resolutions can be hyperbole, I agree. Resolutions frequently have hyperbole. I'm not saying this one does, but they do. They're known for it, just about everyone. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to clarify one thing. I looked at our big, beautiful map up there, and except for I didn't see any rivers flowing from west to east until you get to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where you'll see that there are a few which flow northeast. But I think those are well outside the scope of this resolution.
Okay, any other questions? We still have the resolution before us. Any other discussion about the resolution? Okay, Madam Co-Chair, I'd entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move that we report HDR 9 version 30-LS0303/J from committee with the attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the bill will be referred, it looks like, to the Rules Committee for potential calendaring. Do I have that right? I don't see any other referrals. So we will take an at ease, sign the paperwork, and then commence House Bill 211. On record at precisely 6 on the 13th of April, the next bill before us is House Bill 211, which concerns Game Management Unit 23. Its sponsor is Vice Chair Westlake. He's before us. Vice Chair, if you will give us your name and tell us who you brought with you. I think it's Mr. Wallace. Forrest. Yes.
And I'm Representative Dean Westlake, House District 40.
Yes.
And with me is Forrest Wolf. He's the senior advisor. Now, this is more than Game Management 23. I would let everyone know.
Okay.
It's about the caribou herds in northern Alaska that migrate. And regardless of the game management unit they are, this is about them and perpetuating a healthy herd that traverses the Great North. So the sponsoring is about non-resident hunting requirements for the caribou up here. House Bill 211 affords Alaskans an opportunity to harvest vital subsistence resources while allowing non-resident hunters without a second degree of kin to hunt through requiring a licensed professional guide in order to take a caribou at any of these four Arctic herds, the Western Arctic, the Central Arctic, the Porcupine, and Kashyyyk. The Central Arctic herd population has fallen by 69% since 2010, while the I do apologize about the microphone. Since the Western Arctic herd at 2010, and while the Western Arctic herd has decreased by 41% since 2003, with no definitive cause yet determined for the population decline, now more than ever, it is time to take extra precautions when managing these herds, which are a vital resource to many rural communities depending on subsistence. Recently, Game Management Unit 23 experienced over-harvesting issues, and hunting has been federally closed to anyone that does not reside in the area. It is my hope that by requiring non-resident hunters to be accompanied by a licensed guide who is familiar with the areas and the migration patterns of these magnificent herds, the need for game unit closures similar to the ones in 23 will be prevented. I'd really like support. This is unfamiliar territory for all of us out here. You've got brown bear, you've got sheep, you've got goat. They all have guide requirements because of the inherent dangers of the hunts. The need for guide requirements with caribou is rooted in conflict avoidance with the local residents and the familiarity with the territory and the respect for the resources. With guides out there doing these things, they look for repeat customers. They've got a vested interest in not disrupting caribou migration patterns. And this is something for all of the herds that we'd like to see. One of the things with Game Unit 23 closing down, it was because of the decline in caribou. What we saw was the subsistence harvest declined, the resident harvest numbers declined, and the guided resident harvest declined. And the non-resident unguided transporters, if you will, was the only one that increased. Everything else went down other than the unguided hunts, no real requirements there. So that, I thought I was a genius when I thought this stuff up, is why not do it this way? And we look for people that will have a vested interest in seeing these herds out there and having a interest in just being along the routes rather than being disruptive. Turns out the Canadians beat us a long time at this. The Canadian side of the porcupine herd is managed in exactly this way. Their guide requirement is for non-residents out there, and we're bringing Alaska's caribou regulations in just in line and looking at a successful model out here. So I'm asking for help out here. This bill is still raw. It's a vision for the last great herds in America. So, thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Westlake. Mr. Wolf, is there something you wanted to present to us?
Through the chair, Forrest Wolf, staff to represent Westlake. I don't have anything to add at this time. A presenter, a person here who, does have a time constraint. So if anybody has any questions for Bruce Dale, he's the Director of Wildlife Conservation for the Department of Fish and Game. He can kind of give you a little more in-depth information on the herd migration patterns and stuff like that. So,
do you have a process question, Representative Birch?
I have a question regarding the herd. Is that
all right? I think it.
This gentleman's got a yep. time commitment?
Yes.
Time limitation?
Yes.
Good evening.
Just a question about as far as the number of, and I've actually hunted caribou in the Central Brooks Range, and I guess it would be one of these overlapping herds. What do you attribute the population? I'm an engineer, not an expert in your world, but do you have a kind of a synopsis of what's going on as far as the herd management and herd statistics, population, and so forth, through the chair.
Thank you, through the chair. Bruce Dale, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The herds represented in this bill on the North Slope have mixed histories. The Western Arctic herd has declined substantially, as noted by the sponsor. From 500,000 caribou to just 200,000 was likely a combination of factors. When it was at 500,000, that was a lot of caribou for the range. We noticed some problems with nutrition and then some weather events that probably contributed to the decline. And then there was also probably some age structure issues where there was a lot of older animals out there, and older animals have lower survival rates than prime-aged animals. And now, if the herd continues to decline at the rate it declines, it'll decline substantially. But there are significant signals. I'm starting with the Western Arctic herd because it is the largest herd and one of the ones with the most user conflicts. by far. The herd has some really good signs in the last couple of years, good calf cohorts, good body condition, better pregnancy, but those animals have to grow up and become reproductive age to really contribute to the herd. And so anything could happen at this point. And we have concerns about the herd. We have concerns about the people. To put it in perspective, though, when this herd last had a major decline, it declined to about 75,000 caribou. And at that time, we had maybe 250,000 caribou in the state in the early 70s. And we still have 700 or 750,000 caribou, but down from a million.
Follow-up? Yes, follow-up.
Just a question about hunting pressure, and I know there is a kind of a horrific wanton waste, you know, issue up there. I'm saying the last 5 years or something. I was kids out there going crazy, and they just, you know, kind of randomly dispatched a number of caribou. I assume that's more the anomaly than the. But how do you see hunting pressure, you know, basically the taking of animals for food, if you will. How does that balance with the herd population?
Thank you. Through the chair, the hunting didn't cause the decline. Okay. It's just getting to the point now where hunting has to be restricted at 200,000 caribou and the productivity they have, where hunting has to be restricted, and the Board of Game has enacted some of those restrictions, and the Federal Subsistence Board, of course, closed it for 1 year in a temporary fashion to non-federally qualified users. And just to point out, the other herd, on the other extreme, the porcupine herd is 200,000 caribou, and it's as big as it's ever been. East of that in Canada, herds have declined catastrophically. Mm-hmm. The Central Arctic herd, as mentioned, had declined substantially. Some of that is movements of animals, and we're investigating that. And the Teshikpuk declined, but is still holding pretty steady at 42,000 caribou.
Okay. Last question,
Representative Birch.
Yeah, just last question would be, how does the migration work? Is it generally north to south? Is it highlands to lowlands? Is it? I remember hunting them as a kid, and I guess it would be the Central Arctic herd we were hunting. But how does that migration? I remember seeing them up and over the mountains. And
through the chair, thank you. That generally it is the calving is to the north.
Okay.
Like, for example, in the coastal plain in Anwar for the porcupine herd and northwest Alaska up in the very corner there for the western Arctic herd, Teshikpuk Lake area for that herd, and basically right in the oil patch for the central Arctic herd. And then they winter in the taiga to the south, the boreal forest.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Representative Parrish, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do you anticipate as being the likely ecological and economic impacts of this bill, if it were to become law?
Ecologically, the impacts would be very small. Non-resident harvest is a small component for most of these herds. The economic impact is not my area of specialty, but I can tell you that most of the non-residents that hunt up there are hunting without guides, unguided, like in the neighborhood of 80%. Except, of course, last year with the closure. But in the previous 10-year averages, it ranged in that neighborhood. So it's likely that this will cause a reduction in the number of non-residents that will hunt, but not as much of a reduction as if the federal board keep closing it to non-federally qualified users, because that's zero for non-residents and non-local residents as well.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I imagine that one would expect a decrease in the overall number of non-resident hunters and an increase in the number of guided hunts. Would you agree with that, broadly speaking?
Yes, through the chair. But the degree to that shift is really unknown.
Well, I see some people in the audience who might be able to help us with that. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Dale? I don't see any, and I think at this point what we're going to do is I see Mayor Jewell here. I'm told that you'd like to testify on this, sir.
No longer mayor.
Okay. I can't keep track of those things. But
just call him representative.
I do want to invite those who have invited testimony as to 211, which is the bill before us, And that does include Reggie Jewell, I believe. So if you'd like to come forward. Okay. Okay. Who else did they do? Okay.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the Resources Committee. It's been a while since I've been in this room. Thank you for the opportunity to weigh in a little bit on this issue, because I've tried different things in different ways, and I think this is one way to deal, and I support this measure. I'll just start right off the bat. To address the issue, but there are several issues that are here, and I'll try and keep my remarks brief. You have a declining herd, you have a bunch of user conflict in certain areas, and by restricting out-of-state hunters to and relegating them to guides, I think overall will have a small impact, but oftentimes it's the incremental steps in where you're going that will make a difference. And I would suggest that in the areas of transporters and the big game services guide, that there's a larger issue of being able to give that body some teeth in which to operate, so that we have a better handle on what's going on there. And that in itself is a pretty dicey issue. We dealt with that, and we're able to resurrect the Big Game Services Guide board. But if you look closely at that, there's not a lot of, because it takes resources to manage the resources. And shaking loose some of those resources didn't give all the teeth that needed. And that may have been a whole different way of figuring out how to reduce it. Currently, the situation is, at least in the Western Arctic caribou herd, local residents were allowed to hunt 15 a day, every day of the year, 15 caribou. We're down to 5. Now, we make that work. And there were no closed seasons at one point in time. And now we have closed seasons for both bulls and cows at various times of the year when it's appropriate. And people are making that work. Everybody's giving in a little bit here. And the local residents certainly understand that. And the other thing that I would throw out there, and this has got nothing to do with the bill, and I know it ain't, people don't like this, but boy, the predators are allowed to run rampant. And there's really not a lot of control that's going on in there. And I'm talking about some of the wolves and bears. A whole bunch of wolves that, you know, when the price of gas goes up, people can't afford it. People aren't out there as often as you. This year, the price of gas is down. People are able to get out and monitor some of that herd, but they've had an opportunity to grow. So I've digressed. I think this is an incremental step, and one that probably does impact our economy, and I know it'll impact the local economy. But if you're a resident in Alaska, you still will be able to use a transporter to get out there and provide for your families. So I support this effort.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Mr. Jewell?
Through the chair, good to see you again, my friend.
What's your sense of the? I mean, just in your years in the region, what's your sense of the population variation of the herd? I mean, is it? We've had testimony that it's not due to hunting pressure. I mean, what does it? Is it get you know a drought or a you know deep snow year or the predators or?
I think it's a combination of all of the above. I don't know that any one thing. On the low snow years, I can tell you that the predators have a little more access. Mm-hmm. But I think it's all of those. I think, you know, they're to some degree hunters. But when you look at the percentage, quite frankly, we're responsible for quite a small portion of the take, somewhere probably under 30,000 animals in a herd that's, well, at one point, so it's probably a little less than that currently, but you know when it was at the 450,000 animal mark, but now it's down to 200,000, and you know I think we need to look carefully at all of these measures.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, is there any other testimony that was invited by the sponsor that is present in the room or on the telephone? Mr. Wolf, was there anybody else that you had arranged in advance?
Yeah, through the chair, Forrest Wolf, staff chair, Representative Westlake. excuse me, is Chris McKee online?
He is.
Okay, yeah, he's, excuse me, he's the Wildlife Division Chief in the Office of Subsistence Management.
Okay. Got him.
And I think he can provide a little more context of the Unit 23 situation, you know, how we got to where we are, what the process is for that, and I believe there might be some other future endeavors that are kind of threatening some of the other units to be closed as well. So
great.
I was hoping to have him talk.
He's available. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Mr. McKee, are you available?
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you were just teed up to testify on game unit 23 and the potentiality of similar problems in other game units.
Yes, sir. So as has been mentioned before, the Federal Subsistence Board closed Unit 23 to non-federally qualified users during the current regulatory year. Started on July 1st of last year and ends on June 30th of this year. But we have another special action request that was put in by the Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council requesting that the board close it down for the upcoming regulatory year. So if that special action request is approved by the board, then it would be closed down for another year. So it basically would, they're hoping to have another closure for another year once the current closure ends. So if that was approved, it would be closed from July 1st of this year until June 30th of 2018. So that's where we stand now, specifically in Unit 23, and my staff is responsible for writing the analysis for that closure request. And it goes through several layers of review, both within OSM and outside of the Federal Subsistence Management Program. And then the board uses that analysis along with public testimony to make its decision. So I can't tell you how I'd expect the board to rule, but we're hoping to have that analysis to them as soon as possible because we understand that, you know, we don't want to wind up with a situation where the board doesn't end up ruling on this until it's so close to the hunting season where people want to go up there that they don't really have a reasonable opportunity to know what's going on up there. So I'm really hoping that we get this analysis of the board as soon as possible so they can make a decision on Unit 23. However, we also had the North Slope Regional Subsistence Regional Advisory Council just submit a special action request to us to close down Unit 26A and 26B to non-federally qualified users as well for caribou hunting. So my staff is also working on that analysis. And so if the board was to rule on that, that would close it down. And they approved both the request from the Northwest Arctic RAC and this request from the North Slope, then there's the potential to have all of Unit 23 and all of Unit 26A and 26B closed down to non-federally qualified users. So that's not just non-residents, but it's also non-rural residents of Alaska as well. So it has the potential to affect quite a number of people, both within and outside the state. So that's where we stand now. I should also mention that we have an interagency group meeting that's going to be happening on Monday here in our regional office. It's going to made up of representatives from both the Federal Subsistence Management Program and also all of the federal management agencies, the Park Service, BLM, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Fish and Wildlife Service, and also people with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So we have representatives from both the federal and the state side, and we're really looking, what this group is really looking to do is try to find ways to avoid a unit-wide closure if possible. If that means in a new controlled use area on the state side or targeted closures on the federal side rather than a unit-wide closure, we're not certain at this point, but we're really hoping that this group can come up with some options that we can present to both the federal and state decision makers to see if we can try to avoid another unit-wide closure. But we're not certain, what the results of that meeting are going to be. So I'm hopeful that we can come up with some options that can avoid, having all of Unit 23 closed down. So that's kind of where we're at currently on the federal side.
Okay. Any questions for Wildlife Division Chief Mr. McKee? I don't see any. So we are going to open public testimony at 6:23. And we don't have a huge number of callers, and those on the committee should know that the officials that are standing by are Major Bernard Chastain, who devotes a lot of time to the legislature, I must say, Natalie Weber of ADF&G, and we just have a couple lay callers. And the first is Al Barrett, who's actually very experienced in these matters. Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Al Barrett. I reside in Fairbanks, and I'm representing myself. Let me first state and be very clear that mandatory guiding is not and should not be a tool used for limiting non-resident hunting opportunities. That is no way the intent or the reason mandatory guiding is in statute. It's not a tool to limit non-resident opportunity. With that stated, if we go through the bill, some errors that I see in there that could be possibly amended is in line one, a resident spouse or relative when hunting, that should probably state a second degree of kindred because we have that defined in statute. And the next one would be underneath the section that talks about the misdemeanor with a punishment of $5,000 or no more than $5,000 fine. I have a different copy, so it's hard for me to follow. But I think that's what Mr. Chastain with the governor's bill has been trying to do is to amend those sections to AS 1255, and that would fall underneath House Bill 129 or Senate Bill 60. And the last thing that I have in here is Section G, 9. It only stipulates between the porcupine herd, the central Arctic caribou herd, and the western Arctic caribou herd. So I'm curious on how somebody would be able to distinguish a Tushapuk caribou from a western Arctic caribou or a Tushapuk caribou from a western Arctic caribou because the Tushapuk herd lies in between both of those two herds. So I'm curious on how that would be enforced. And that is my testimony for today, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and I think relative to the Tushapuk, there may be an amendment at some point, Mr. Barrett. And I appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Barrett? I don't see any. So we're going to go now to Mark Richards in Fairbanks.
Good evening, Chairman Josephson and members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska, and I'll be testifying for our organization today. You should have received our letter in opposition to HB 211 sent on April 10th, but I don't see it in the document packet. We want to state at the outset that we firmly believe that only the legislature should have the authority to add to the list of must-be-guided species under Alaska Statute 16.05.407 and .408. Some of you may not be aware that the Board of Game, without legislative approval, has already added moose and black bear to the list of must-be-guided species in some areas. when they've done that with moose in the interior, it has ended up restricting resident opportunities in order to provide a guaranteed allocation to guides. As you heard previously, all non-local federally qualified subsistence hunters have been prohibited from hunting the Western Arctic bird on federal lands in Unit 23 in the northwest region of the state. That includes all non-residents and all Alaskans who do not live in the region. Recently, at the February Board of Game Meeting in Fairbanks, the board severely reduced seasons and bag limits for the Central Arctic herd for both residents and non-residents due to the declines in the herd size. And that, by the way, came about via our very own Resident Hunters of Alaska proposal. There is currently in the works another federal wildlife special action request to restrict all non-local federally qualified subsistence hunters from hunting the Central Arctic herd on federal lands. If the intent of this bill is to reduce non-resident harvests when caribou herds are in steep declines, that is something Resident Hunters of Alaska agrees with and has already been proposing to the Board of Game, that in all cases, if and when any wildlife population is in decline and resident needs and opportunity are going to be restricted, we should first reduce or eliminate all non-resident hunting opportunity. Those are functions of the Board of Game, which the legislature has given authority to deal with these matters. Requiring non-residents to hire a guide to hunt these herds, however, in order to reduce non-resident harvest, is in no way a solution to less non-resident hunting and harvest. What this bill would do is create a new subsidy to guides that wasn't there before, and we can't use the current percentages of unguided versus guided caribou hunters on the North Slope and say that those percentages would remain the same should this bill pass. I know you're all engaged in end-of-session budget matters and that the sponsor wants to start a discussion on this issue. We appreciate that. I look forward to seeing you in Juneau during the extended session to talk more about this bill and other matters of concern to Resident Hunters of Alaska. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Richards? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not entirely clear on how this would result in a new subsidy to guides. As I said earlier, I imagine it would result in a larger absolute number of guided hunts. It would be then your expectation that there might be some some reduction to the allocation for Alaska residents. Is that correct?
That's a function of the Board of Game. It would take too long to go into examples of how when the board has added new must-be-guided species, it's resulted in restrictions on residents because the board is then beholden to provide that allocation. But I guess an analogy would be like, say you had the freedom to buy prime beef at the store, but you could hire a prime beef guide who would assure that you've got a higher quality of prime beef. And then the legislature required all prime beef shoppers to hire that guide. Well, that doesn't mean that the demand for prime beef is pretty high. It doesn't mean that you're going to have less prime beef harvest or less prime beef shoppers, meaning non-resident hunters. The subsidy you're providing, you have guides that would apply to guide in that area because you're providing a guaranteed client base. So you would have guides that would apply to guide in these areas that would take up that slack. So that would be the subsidy that you're providing.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Are the prime beef guides resident Alaskans?
No, not all contracting guides are Alaskans. Certainly a larger portion of assistant guides are non-residents. So not all guides are residents, if that's what you're asking, Representative Parrish.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, we have one last caller, and his name is Jake Jacobson of Kodiak. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, just give us your name and any affiliation you can testify.
My name is Jake Jacobson. I live in Kodiak and Kotzebue. I represent myself and more than 40 Alaska resident family members. I appreciate the opportunity to give my views. I've hunted and eaten caribou from the Western Arctic herd for 50 years, and I've guided for caribou in that herd for 45 years. I worked for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for 12 years in the 70s and 80s. Our primary focus was on caribou and Game Management Unit 23 and 26. In 1972, ADF&G estimated the population of the Western Arctic herd at 242,000. They were concerned that that large number, the highest known for that herd, might overgraze and cause a great die-off. So we constructed exclosures on the North Slope and in the Selawik River Basin and so forth to be able to observe the tundra that had been grazed by caribou and that that had not. Botanists that I took out there said they noticed no difference. There was no great threat of overgrazing at 242,000. But ADF&G was concerned about that, so they opened the season to no closed season, no limits, and caribou could be sold, and many caribou were sold. $35 a carcass was the going rate in those days. In any event, now the herd is estimated at over 200,000, and I expect there will be another count this year. I expect it'll be well over 200,000. As for over harvest, the harvest there that's recorded is an estimated 12,000 to 15,000 for local subsistence users and 5 to 600 for non-locals, that being transported in guided hunts. And the harvest records for the guided and transported hunters is accurate. It's an estimate for the locals. Anyway, this bill, I do favor it overall. As another person mentioned earlier, I think that term in the first part an act requiring a non-resident to be accompanied by a guide or resident spouse or relative, that should be clearly defined, and the relative should be second degree of kindred, as is used in other big game hunts in Alaska that require a guide. In any event, let me see here. I've got some scribbled notes. This bill will, without a doubt, reduce and defuse user conflicts in Game Management Unit 23. That is, and it will restore Alaska residents' access to caribou hunting in Unit 23, provided the Federal Subsistence Board does not continue with their WSA 1601, which unconscionably kept all but local subsistence users from accessing that herd. In any event, imperfect as it is, I do support passage of HB 211. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Any questions for this gentleman? I don't see any. I'm going to close public testimony because there's no one remaining at 6:35. And I'm going to ask that amendments like the one that he recommended, and I might talk to the sponsor about the second degree of kindred issue, be forwarded to the co-chairs by noon tomorrow when we will resume this bill. Well, we'll resume the bill at 1, but the amendments would be due at noon tomorrow. So we will hold this bill for the next 18 hours or so, and I'm going to turn the chairmanship over to Representative Tarr to proceed with the other bills.
Okay, we are going to bring House Bill 177 back before the committee.
Oh boy, see on that.
We left public testimony open on House Bill 177 online. I think three people are online available for questions, and then one individual for comments. So if Tim Stallard is still on the line, we'll take your public testimony.
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Hi. Go ahead. We'd love to hear your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. My name is Tim Stallard, and I live in Anchorage. And I am chair of and representing SNPM, which is the Alaska Committee for Noxious and Invasive Pest Management. So we're the professional association for the study and management of invasive species in Alaska. So we are enthusiastically in support of this bill and grateful to see it progressing again to the legislature. Just as a reminder, invasive species are defined as those that cause harm to natural resources, in addition to perhaps health and economic values. Across the United States, invasive species cause hundreds of billions of dollars
each year in crop losses, infrastructure damage, plus ecological harm. And so, you know, we're very lucky in Alaska that our relatively, you know, low population and extreme climate have slowed down the arrival and establishment of invasive species, but many are right on our doorstep, so we need to be prepared to take rapid action to address new ones as they arrive. A metaphor that I like for invasive species is a biological wildfire. And just like with a wildfire, you know, it's best to prevent these issues in the first place. And secondarily, when they do show up, to catch them and respond very quickly, which is exactly the intent of this bill, is to help empower our departments, Department of Fish and Game, you know, as well as Natural Resources and other agencies to respond quickly. So we definitely like this bill. We do, in addition to kind of the early language addressing watercraft arriving via the marine highway, there's quite a number of invasive species vectors that should be addressed either in statute or in regulation, such as watercraft arriving via our land borders, plus arriving at our marine ports, arriving aircraft, and any sort of imported material or equipment that might be placed in our water bodies. Additional issues are release of pets, aquaria dumping, illegal stocking, you know, what's called the bucket biologist. We, you know, also should address in-state movement of boats and equipment between water bodies, just to ensure that if boats are moving between water bodies, boats or trailers, within the same day, that they're required to be, you know, cleaned, drained, and dry. And just, we want to make sure that our state agencies are empowered rapidly and effectively write regulations that respond to aquatic invasive issues, species issues. We are a bit concerned with Division of Agriculture is more than 5 years behind in updating their regulations regarding the noxious weed list, which is more of a terrestrial plant issue, but there are a few aquatic species such as reed canary grass and American white water lily, which are highly invasive yet still can be legally sold in our state. So I think, you know, we, of course, all Alaskans, we are so passionate about our natural resources, you know, because we rely on them for food, work, and fun. And these species do threaten our way of life. So we support this bill and the effort of our state agencies to address these issues. We wanted to note that this bill has had very strong bipartisan support in past legislative sessions. So we thank Representative Tarr and all members of the House Resources Committee for supporting this bill and helping move it forward. So we hope that this will be the session that it can cross the finish line. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sallard. Do we have any questions for the testifier? Okay, well, I'm glad we were able to get to you before you have to go off to the community council meeting. Thank you so much. Online, if there, and I think these folks are just available again for questions, but if there's anyone that you want to hear from, Michael Nissel from .puff is here, and we have Tammy Davis online from Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We have Rob Carter from the Agriculture Plant Materials Center in Palmer, as well as the Division Director for Agriculture, Mr. Keyes. So does anyone have any questions for any of those individuals? Mr. Keyes, did you want to respond to the comment about the Division of Ag being behind on updating the list for noxious weeds?
Yes, Chair Carr, I would.
Okay, please go ahead.
For the record, this is Arthur Keyes, Director of Agriculture. I have been made very, very well aware of where we are at with the regulations here at the Division of Agriculture, the noxious weed regulations that need to be updated, unfortunately, are just one of many of the regulations that we have on our plate to update, and we are actively seeking staff members to work on these regulations. So it is on our plate. We're aware of it, and we are looking to have some progress this year with these regs.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Keyes? Okay. Thank you. If there are no other questions, and I see no one else online. Oh, Representative Parrish.
I have a question for Captain Newsel, if you wouldn't mind coming forward, and with the indulgence of the chair.
Certainly.
Thank you. Do you have an approximate figure for the number of trailers and vessels coming into the state annually?
Through the chair, I'm Michael Newsel, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, overseeing the Marine Highway System, to Representative Parrish. In response to the question asked yesterday or 2 days ago, we did provide a written response that does provide information in terms of traffic volumes coming into the state from Bellingham and Prince Rupert. Those are not actually just boats. And the definition of boat or watercraft, I guess, is a little bit nebulous, because there could be kayaks, canoes, all kinds of personal watercraft, jet skis, whatnot, on the vehicles that we carry into the state. We do not count or track those individually by those measures. But the information we do have was provided in a written response.
Let's see.
And I think it looks like that's on page 2, and I'll just say it so for those listening in. From Prince Rupert, 77 port calls, 2,753 vehicles embarked. And from Bellingham, Washington, 68 port calls and 5,689 vehicles embarked. So quite a number.
3%, so that'd be 30.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I couldn't find that faster, as fast as you could. Thank you. I will note that we do track non-motorized vehicles that come into the state. Many of those are bicycles that are walk-on passengers, walk-on with their bicycle. But we also have walk-on passengers, walk-on with canoes and kayaks as well. That number total system-wide was 1,755 non-motorized vehicles. Again, I don't have the breakdown. We don't have a breakdown between bicycles, canoes, kayaks.
Follow-up?
Continue.
Thank you. So it looks like if we take 0.3% of the approximately 8,000 vehicles embarked, and 0.3 is the proportion which are trailers and excluding tractor trailers, then we see only about 240 coming from Prince Rupert and Bellingham in fiscal year 2015. Is that approximately right?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, it is based on a lot of assumptions that go into making that calculation. The definition of trailers is provided on the attachment to the letter that we sent. Mm-hmm. And if I can find it here, that can include all kinds of trailers, not just trailers carrying boats, obviously. So a trailer carrying motorcycles or a trailer carrying whatever people carry. Again, we don't track that separately.
All right, a follow-up?
Thank you. And it's a bit outside your bailiwick, but I did also inquire whether you had any information about the number of boats coming into the state outside of the Marine Highway System. And if you don't, that's quite all right. It isn't, again, your area of control.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I do not have that. I don't believe the DOT has that. Border crossings might be, I'm not sure if they track that information or not. That would be a place to look, I would think.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions while we have the Deputy Commissioner? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and, did I close public testimony? I don't think I did. So I'm going to close public testimony. And the bill is before us. I do have one amendment. And I will offer this amendment. I'll move amendment number 1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
And does everyone have a copy of the amendment? It should be in your packets. So this amendment is in response to the very question Representative Parrish just asked because one of the goals here, you know, this bill is creating an infrastructure for a rapid response fund and creating, you know, sort of the steps that will take place under those circumstances so that there aren't delays like the Elodia problem that we heard about a couple days ago, where It was a 5-acre problem, and then after 2 years, it was a 500-acre problem. So we need to have a mechanism for a rapid response. However, we've also heard how costly these invasive weed infestations can be, aquatics and others. And so we've been, you know, we have two provisions with the adoption of this amendment that try to get more on the prevention side of things. The first provision is in the bill as it exists right now, and this is the part that's on page three, that directs the folks at the Alaska Marine Highway to give this information, the preventative information. We looked at a couple of the examples the other day. So then when we were discussing, you know, what are some of the other concerns of other boats or float planes, and what the amendment does here is direct the Department of Administration, and that's where DMV is housed, to also give this information out when someone registers a boat with the department. And so because, you know, as a private owner, you could purchase this, you know, boat this at any time, you know, and that could happen through a private sale with another individual. The state's not really necessarily involved in that financial transaction. Where the state would be involved is that those are required to be registered with the state, just like you register your car through the DMV. So that is an opportunity where we can intervene and provide that communication. And so what the amendment seeks to do is, you know, a second preventative measure that would provide this important information to individuals at the time that they go and register. And they do need to register shortly after purchasing that, whether it be, you know, a canoe should be registered or, you know, a motorized boat. And so this would be an opportunity to do this. The reason it doesn't also involve the float planes is that that is actually regulated by the Federal Aviation Administration. And so the registration, we have limited ability to intervene in that because it's a federal jurisdiction. So at least we would try and get folks as they come on the Marine Highway from the lower 48, and then also when they're registering with the DMV. So that is an explanation of the amendment. I don't know if there are any questions about the amendment.
I have just one. Would the Marine Highway system still be required to, to educate and inform, or are we removing that?
We're not removing that. We're adding to it. So there'd be two ways that the communication would happen, so that individuals traveling from the lower 48 coming up on the Marine Highway would receive the information, and then individuals when they go to the DMV to register a boat, and that way, you know, from the effective date of this bill, for example, if I look in the newspaper or online and I see someone selling their, you know, skiff and I go out and buy it, you know, then I'm going to have to go register that at the DMV in my name as the new owner, and at that time the DMV would provide that information. So trying to get at as many of those prevention opportunities as possible.
Thank you.
Do you maintain your objection?
I do not. I will withdraw my objection.
Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Just a minute.
Oh.
Continue the objection.
Okay.
You're deleting users of the Alaska Marine Highway System and inserting certain persons registering or transporting boats. So other than Captain Newsel is here, where does the bill still say to the Alaska Marine Highway System to inform transporters of boats?
So on page 3, the section 2, that is not being deleted. And so this is person who purchases a ticket for vehicle. So I think the title has just been amended because instead of just being specific to the Marine Highway System, now it's more generalized to persons either registering or transporting boats.
Okay. I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Is there further objection to adopting Amendment Number 1? Okay. Seeing no further objection, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. I don't have any other amendments, so that brings House Bill 177 before the committee for discussion. Is there any discussion?
A little bit. On page 2, line 1, it says that response to and management of an aquatic invasive species under A of this section shall be given priority over activities regulated by the department in the area where an incipient population, et cetera, is being targeted. I am a little concerned that if there were an invasive population which could not be eradicated in a reasonable time frame, although it could be suppressed, that priority would override other vital activities of the department. Probably someone online could set my mind at ease about that.
Let's see here. Well, do you want to talk to Tammy Davis from Department of Fish and Game? Maybe she could try and address that.
Sure. Thank you.
Ms. Davis, are you available?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear Representative Parrish's question?
If he could repeat it, please.
Sure. My concern begins on page 1, line 14, that is subsection C. And I'm only concerned about the words given priority over activities regulated by the department, because there may be other mission-critical activities taking place, and I don't know how you would interpret it on your end. Would you drop other mission-critical activities to focus your resources on something which might be adequately addressed? Or you do get to the point of diminishing returns any time that there's added effort. So would the language be given priority in any way impede your other mission critical activities?
Through the chair, Representative, not being an attorney or a legislator or even someone who does very much statute interpretation, please take that into consideration with my response. When I read that statement, I would believe that responding to that introduced population would be the number one priority.
Yeah. Follow up?
And Representative Parrish, keep in mind the purpose of this bill is a rapid response, and mm-hmm. so it's supposed to create the infrastructure necessary to immediately respond, because otherwise there is an extensive sort of regulatory process that has to be followed if there's not a process in place, and that delay is what we're trying to avoid so that you can respond before the problem is more serious.
Mm-hmm. I suppose my concern is that in areas like Sitka, where they've got the DVEX problem, which is a severe problem, granted, that this would be directing the fish and game resources in the area away from other critical activities that they're taking part in. And that's a little bit worrisome for me. That's the only part I really I'd tripped over in the, well, it's one of a grand total of 3 parts that I tripped over, but that one I hit the ground hardest on. So I'm happy to have my concerns allayed if that can be done.
Well, Representative Parrish, we have Tammy on the line from Department of Fish and Game, and that is the only individual we have from Fish and Game on the line this evening.
What was her full name?
Tammy Davis.
Ms. Davis, would you remind me of your position with Fish and Game?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Parrish, I'm the invasive species coordinator.
Oh, good. That's a good person to have on the line. So in the case of Sitka, where we're managing a incipient invasive population, which is aquatic, would this change the way that Fish and Game has already been managing it?
Again, I feel like it's important that I let you know that I'm a biologist more so than a policy person. The efforts that have taken place in Sitka thus far have not taken away the DVEX efforts, have not taken away from other management priorities of the department. However, there were decisions. The department requested that boaters avoid Whiting Harbor because of the invasive species. And because we don't have authority to keep boaters out of that area, it was a friendly request. I guess I'm sort of going off on a tangent there. I guess you're asking a policy question of a management biologist, and so I'm not feeling very comfortable responding to how statute would be interpreted.
It's really refreshing to hear scientific humility in this building. You know what you don't know, and I suppose I should confess to a little bit of that as well. I'm also not a lawyer. I have a degree in biology, although I bet not as nice a one as yours. Thank you for your answer, Ms. Davis.
Do you have additional questions, Representative Parrish?
Well.
And I should just announce, I feel bad, the folks that have been waiting for House Bill 197, the bill sponsor just left. So I think that means she may not be available any longer, and so we will not be able to hear that bill this evening.
How would it be if we deleted the language overactivities regulated the department in the area? So it shall be given priority where an incipient population of an aquatic invasive species is being targeted. So it's...
Representative Parrish, the intent of the bill, though, is so that they are able to legally prioritize management of an invasive species, aquatic invasive species outbreak. So I think we actually do want them to be able to prioritize it because they have other, you know, statutorily mandated obligations in terms of their day-to-day activities. And what this is trying to create is an infrastructure so that if there is something, and the whole point, you know, the invasives, the potential for them to spread very quickly means you want to take as immediate action as possible. And I think they actually want to be able to sort of, you know, if it was necessary, be able to separate those responsibilities legally so that they could prioritize managing that outbreak. And so I don't think we want to take that out of there, as I understand it, because the whole point is so that they, you know, can prioritize in that way.
Would it, this mandates that they shall prioritize in that way rather than giving them permission. Would you be amenable to changing the shall to a may?
I do not support that change at this time. I think I would need to go back to the department and have some additional conversations because I think, you know, it would change the intent of the bill and what we're trying to accomplish.
I've received reassurance from the Department of Fish and Game that it is more of an intense statement and not one that would prevent them from accomplishing other high-priority activities. My fears are soothed.
Okay. That is very helpful. Thank you. Did you have additional questions, Representative Parrish?
Yes. Sorry, Madam Chair. I should have come to you earlier. On page 2...
Lesson learned.
Line 17. The department shall respond in a manner determined to cause the least harm to non-invasive fish populations that are used for recreational, personal use, commercial, or subsistence purposes. typically the manner that causes the least harm is the most expensive. And there are some species that if we carpet bomb them, they'll be back in two seasons. Wonderful critters. So I suppose I'll just put my concern about that on record. And
keep in mind, Representative Parrish, that what the fund that's created by this mm-hmm. bill is not funded at this time, but again, it creates the infrastructure, so should there be an aquatic invasive outbreak, then there's a place for the money to go. Mm-hmm. And it's true that it's possible that the least harmful could be more expensive, but I don't have that concern right now. I mean, I would prefer they use, for example, mechanical means of managing an invasive species before using chemical means. And so, you know, my preference is for that to be there for that very reason. And we see that a lot with invasives, for example, and other corridors, transportation corridors, where the departments often want to use pesticides. And that's the less expensive option, but there are mechanical control options. And so I think, you know, leaving that language in there gives that flexibility, and that would have to be determined, you know, at the time that the financial request was made as to which would be the most appropriate method for control or eradication, and then the associated cost.
Sorry to be difficult. In the event, say, of a Lodi outbreak where herbicide is deemed to be the most effective means of eradicating a large population, but it would be less harmful to use a mechanical approach, but prohibitively expensive to deal with the entirety of an outbreak. This would seem to mandate that they use to the extent possible, the mechanical method, even if it would provide only an incomplete solution.
Representative Parrish, I don't think the alternative selected would be the one that provides an incomplete solution. I mean, the goal would be eradication of that aquatic invasive. However, you know, in the case of using, you know, chemicals like a pesticide or something, and that's what they do with the northern pike, you know, people do have concerns about using chemicals in our freshwater lakes and streams. So, I want that language there because I want the consideration for the non-invasive species, and we would want to minimize the potential for harm to those.
Oh yeah, by and large, I'm also opposed to dumping poison in our lakes. dear. But I'd be more excited about one where it were geared at the minimal total ecological impact, which in the short term could be rather intense, but over the long term not so much. Otherwise, I will content myself with that and withdraw my objection if I had one.
I don't think you had an objection, but I appreciate that. So we have the bill before us as amended. Is there additional committee discussion? Brief at ease. And if there's no further business to come before the committee, then we will adjourn at 7:08 p.m.